advising her starving subjects to eat cake. Few other historical events have given rise to so many iconic images. Recycled in paintings, literature, and film, sometimes actually created by them, such images have entered deeply into our collective imagination. From David's myth-making canvases of the Revolution years to Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities, from Baroness Orczy's Scarlet Pimpernel to Carry On, Don't Lose Your Head, writers and artists have bequeathed us a revolution on the border between fact and fiction, a gallery of arresting tableau and grand historical gestures. But what lies behind that facade of cliché and iconography? What really happened in France and the wider world during those turbulent closing years of the 18th century? And what relevance does it have for us at the beginning of the 21st? The French Revolution was not a single event. Rather, it was a highly complex network of events concentrated in the decade between 1789 and 1799, and especially the first half of that decade, but extending in its origins to much earlier periods and in its effects to much later ones. For all the millions of words written about it, the Revolution remains one of the most confusing periods in modern European history. Driven sometimes by individuals, sometimes by the unpredictable dynamics of the crowd, it seems often to develop a momentum of its own, independent of its principal actors. Protagonists rise and are swept away, sometimes on waves of terrifying violence. Allegiances split and shift. Political structures form and mutate, generated and dissolved in a volatile compound of ideology and improvisation. No sooner do you think you've got a grip on it than it changes into something else. Little wonder, then, that more than 200 years after Napoleon Bonaparte famously declared it finished, the French Revolution continues to divide historians and political scientists as sharply as it divided contemporary observers. So how did it begin, this seismic upheaval whose shockwaves would spread throughout Europe and beyond? France, on the eve of revolution, was an absolute monarchy. The 34-year-old king, Louis XVI, was the great-great-great-grandson of Louis XIV, the Sun King, who built the spectacular palace at Versailles, from which the Bourbon dynasty ruled through its appointed ministers and regional intendants. Louis XVI was a contradictory figure, stubborn but indecisive, open to new ideas but convinced of his divine right to rule, profoundly conscious of his dignity but shambling and awkward of address. As head of a court of extravagant Baroque formality, he was happiest on the hunting field or pursuing his unlikely hobby of locksmithery. Despite his remoteness, however, he was far from unpopular with his subjects. Even in the early phase of the Revolution, Louis was generally regarded as a well-meaning father to the nation, led astray by his ministers and, above all, by his Austrian wife, the much-maligned Marie Antoinette. His kingdom, too, was riddled with contradictions. The central power of the monarchy coexisted with a bewildering array of local structures, rules and regulations, governing everything from the transport of salt to the price of playing cards. Until the introduction of the metric system, itself a product of the revolution, there wasn't even a consistent nationwide system of weights and measures. The tax burdens imposed by this patchwork of zones and jurisdictions were widely deplored, and the government's privatized tax collectors, the farmers general, universally hated. Perhaps most resented of all were the so-called seigneurial or feudal dues, payments in cash or kind to local lords. Even here, however, matters were far from straightforward. French society was formally divided into three estates: the clergy, the first estate, the nobility, the second, and the commons, the third. But these divisions masked a complicated reality. For one thing, nobility was a tradable commodity. The sale of honours, especially offices carrying noble status, was a government cash cow, and many aristocratic families had bought their titles only in the last couple of generations. Furthermore, while noble status conferred mouth-watering tax exemptions, more than half the nobility was still seriously hard up.